There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, another hour to work with here on a Thursday afternoon in Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. Glad you're along. And text lines open at 343-0106. And coming up, we're checking with Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon. Got some good news here for oyster harvest in the state of Alabama. He'll join us here after the bottom of the hour news. And I mentioned this going into the break. I set this up. So I'm reading all the news accounts that I can, as always. And the other day, I've saw the story over at AL.com, and a study about researchers at the University of Alabama Birmingham, UAB, that have revealed that fossils found in West Alabama belong to a turtle. Yeah, okay, you're like, yeah. Who swam the seas, okay, 75 million years ago. And just then all of a sudden I locked in and consumed that article and found the name of Dr. Drew Gentry from UAB, who led the study, and he's joining us now on Midday Mobile. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is not every day we get in a story. I mean, we got old stuff, and you know, we're a state. We just got done with that bicentennial for the state, celebrating 200 years. That's old, right? 200-year-old
right.
State. And then I see 75 million years. Wow. Wow. So talk about this, because this history is actually, in the short term, about a two-decade history that led to this finding.
That is correct. Actually, those fossils were found a number of years ago and were donated to McWane Science Center in Birmingham, where they sat unstudied for the better part of 20 years. And it wasn't until I came along and we spent almost a year comparing these fossils with the fossils of almost every other known fossil sea turtle from around the world until we figured out that we actually had something unique, something new to science.
Now, this is a new species, or it says here a new genus?
It is a new genus. The new species would just be, if we had a genus that we already knew about that we could assign it to, if we had a genus that we knew about, we could just say it was a new species and assign it to that genus, but we couldn't find anything even close to it. There was nothing we could compare to this animal, and so we actually had to name an entirely new genus and species. So it is Asmodechiles parami. Asmodechiles is the genus, and then parami is the species name.
I'm glad you said that, because I wasn't even going to try to attempt that name. Okay, so Drew, as you look at this, you're going through and you're like, you have obviously comparable fossils of other sea turtles, and you know that this is not the progenitor of, I guess, the sea turtles we see today. Or what's the relationship?
Well, it's very closely related to the sea turtles that we have today. So when we look at the features of Asmodechiles and compare those to the features of other fossil sea turtles and then the sea turtles that we have now, what we found out was that Asmodechiles is actually very similar to the fossil sea turtles that occur right before we get the earliest ancestors of the species that are alive today. So it's what's called in biology the most recent common ancestor. So if you look at all of the seven species of sea turtle alive today, they all come down to one point in their lineage, and basically they have a single common ancestor. And Asmodechiles is right there at the base of that.
So, okay, so this is the, obviously, I know none of this is accurate, but this is the great-great-great-grandfather?
That's essentially right. It is the great-great-grandfather of the species of sea turtle that we have alive today. It's very difficult to identify those, though, because we have the six species of sea turtle that most people are familiar with. They're pretty standard sea turtles. And then we've got the weird one. We've got the leatherback.
Yeah.
Dermichelys, which is really, really bizarre. It's unlike any of the other sea turtles that we have. And so figuring out how those species are related to one another and what was the common ancestor that they came from has always been kind of challenging. And as Motocheles looks like maybe right there at the base of the common ancestor of the genealogy or the family tree of sea turtles.
Now, in living creatures, we think about, I think about the advances made through genome research, right? That you can look back right. And see these. But when you're dealing with, let me point out once again, y'all, 75-million-year-old fossils, you've got to get, I mean, this is just straight research, right? I mean, you got to figure it out.
That's right. Unfortunately, we don't have any DNA that we can use with these fossils, despite what you might see on, Jurassic Park, right. Where we can pull DNA out of fossils. It really doesn't work like that. DNA breaks down after a few hundred thousand years, and so we don't really have any DNA that we can work with these things. So we have to use the features of the skeleton. So we use the different features that are present in the skeleton of this turtle. We can compare it to the features of all the other fossil sea turtles that we know about from around the world, and then we can compare those to the features of the skeletons of the sea turtles that we have today.
All right. So, Dr. Gentry, let me ask you a question. This is the one I know you probably get in the grocery store when somebody sees you. So, Drew, how big was this thing? What did it look like?
Well, his Motocheles was actually a fairly good-sized sea turtle. It was probably about 3 or 4 feet long from the front of its shell to the back of its shell. If you toss the head in there and the tail, it may have been almost 2 meters long, so maybe 5 or 6 feet long. So it was a fairly large sea turtle. And it looked unlike really any of the sea turtles that we have today, because unlike the smooth sort of flat shells that we have on modern sea turtles, as Motocheles would have had these large serrations going along the center part of its back that would have looked like saw blades coming up out of the top of its back, and the edge of its shell was also moderately serrated. So it was a very strange looking sea turtle.
I would say, I mean, this is like it's like the chopper shop show version of a sea turtle. Oh, they've made a thing look.
Yeah, that's good.
As we go back here too, as I keep focusing on y'all, that this is fossil 75 million years old, and they were not found out in the Gulf. They were found in what, Wilcox County and Sumter County?
Wilcox and Sumter County, Alabama. That's right. And then a county in Mississippi that I am not even going to attempt to pronounce.
The Okatiba or whatever. Anything that sounds like that.
Yep.
Like from a Faulkner novel. One of those counties up there. Okay, so you're talking about finding these in an area that's well inland from the coast. Let's talk about how you find that fossil, and then help me understand, like, when I'm traipsing around the woods up in the Black Belt and I come up to one of those chalk banks and I fill my vest pockets full of fossils, what's going on?
So the chalk that you're actually walking around in is part of what used to be the old floor of the ocean. That used to be at the bottom of the ocean millions of years ago, towards the end of the time of the dinosaurs and what's known as the Cretaceous period. That was all underwater. Most of Alabama used to be at the bottom of a shallow tropical sea. It would have been a lot more like the Bahamas today than what we think of as being Alabama today. And so all of that chalk, if you actually were to take a small little bit of that chalk and look at it under a microscope, all that chalk is made up of millions and millions of tiny exoskeletons of plankton that used to live in the ocean. That's what that chalk is all made up of. That's why it's so rich for agriculture. That's why we can grow so many different crops in it, is because it's basically these tiny little planktonic exoskeletons. And so that used to be at the bottom of the ocean, and it was the bottom of the ocean for a very, very long time. In fact, if you drive south in Alabama, if you're going south from Birmingham, headed towards Mobile on 65, I'm sure people have driven over the fall line before, where you suddenly lose lots and lots of elevation right mm-hmm. there as you're going south. You're actually driving off of the old shoreline. That's actually where the ocean used to meet, right there at the shore, is what is now the fall line, where you have that huge drop in elevation. And so all that used to be underwater for millions of years is a very, very rich area for fossils. In fact, Alabama is one of the best places in the world to find marine fossils from that period of time. We don't just have sea turtles here in Alabama. We have sea turtle fossils and sharks and fish. We have giant mosasaurs, which were sort of like giant ocean-going crocodiles. They're all over the state, and especially in the Black Belt area. People come from around the world to study the fossils from the Alabama Black Belt.
Is it true? Is it because they were preserved better there? Because I'm picturing, okay, so we have, there's the shoreline, like we're falling off there at, you know, we're coming out of Autauga, coming out of Prattville, heading down to Montgomery. Here comes the big fault line down there, and you're heading down to now the old C4. But that over time must have, I mean, it didn't recede in 2 days, right? So there, wouldn't there be secondary, tertiary, quadrant, you know, as it moved back to the south?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the Black Belt is the part of the shoreline that was underwater during the Cretaceous, right towards the end of the time of the dinosaurs. But as ocean levels receded and as they moved back, the shoreline moved closer and closer to where it is today. But if you go just a little bit south of those Cretaceous chalks, you get into parts of the areas that were covered in water during the time after the time of the dinosaurs. And so those would be in what are known as the Cenozoic era. So you get Eocene and Miocene periods of time where we have our state fossil. Bacillosaurus was a large Eocene fossil whale, and the fossils of Bacillosaurus are so common in the parts of the state south of that fall line, or parts of the state that are south of that Cretaceous chalk. Bacillosaurus fossils are so common that people would actually find the fossilized backbones or the vertebrae of these animals and then use these big cylindrical rocks to prop up their porches and make mailbox posts, because the Bacillosaurus fossils were everywhere.
Wait a second. So people were shimming up the front porch there on their house in Alabama with the vertebra of an ancient whale?
That is absolutely correct. It's unbelievable the number of fossils that we have in this state. It is, the fossil resources of Alabama are truly one of the hidden treasures of our state that hardly anyone know about. And that's what we're trying to do, is trying to sort of raise awareness about the fact that these things are out there. And the people that live in these areas are actually not often surprised by the fact that we're coming out to look for them. They know about them. They know they're out there. They just didn't think anybody cared. And you have stories all the time of people that live in those areas south of the Cretaceous Black Belt that have found whale bones in their ditch behind their house or out in their field when they're farming. It's not surprising to them. I mean, they know they're out there. But that the Eocene of Alabama and the Cenozoic of Alabama is also just as rich with fossils as the areas where we found Asmodechiles. It's just a different part and just a different time period.
Talking to Dr. Drew Gentry from UAB about the find of a new genus and species of these sea turtles, but the bigger discussion of fossils in Alabama. Are we just, because, I mean, if you think about this, and I've been around these and picked them out of riverbanks and cut roads and all that over the years, but have we failed at marketing this? Because if I'm picturing a Hollywood movie about finding fossils, they're in the desert, Drew. They're in Mongolia, yeah, in the steppe, or they're in the deserts of the Southwest. They sure as heck aren't in Alabama.
And that, unfortunately, is what everybody thinks. Everybody assumes that in order to find fossils, you have to go out west. You have to go out into the desert, or you have to go out to places like Mongolia or China or somewhere exotic to find these fossils. But the truth is, they're right here. And Alabama is actually very, very unique in the number of fossils that we have. We have more fossils in our state than anywhere else in the country, and it has to do with our geology. If you start in the far northern part of our state, if you go up to Sand Mountain near the Huntsville area,
sure,
you're actually looking in rocks that are about 350 to 400 million years old. And then as you go south, you're actually getting younger and younger and younger in the rocks that you're looking in. So by the time you get to about Birmingham, you're starting to enter into those periods of time just before the dinosaurs. Then you get south of Birmingham, you're in the time of the dinosaurs. You go a little bit further south, and now you're after the dinosaurs in the age of mammals. And then the further south that you go, by the time you get into really far in the southern part of Alabama, if you're getting towards Mobile, you're getting into the Pleistocene, the Ice Age, where we find saber-toothed cats and mammoths and mastodons, and all of those things are in the south part of the state. And that is so rare. You do not get that really anywhere else, where you have this just complete sequence from start to finish.
Wait a second. You're telling me if I get to digging enough in the backyard, I can find the fossils of a short-faced bear or something from the Pleistocene there? Or?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have all kinds of stuff from South Alabama from a period of time called the Pleistocene era, which is the Ice Age. The last Ice Age was during the Pleistocene. And that stuff is all over. We have Baldwin County. We have lots of fossils from Baldwin County. And they're all mammal fossils. Generally, we get large mammals. We have giant ground sloths, and we have huge armadillos called glyptodonts that were these 8-foot-long armadillos We've got really great fossils from the southern part of Alabama. We have lots and lots of really great ice age stuff here as well.
Just thinking about the damage they would do to my front yard. The regular size armadillos do enough, but an 8-footer. Wow. All right. Listen, what a discovery. And this is fascinating. And congratulations on this for you and all the research and all the time. I know this doesn't happen overnight, but having a new genus and species is really something to talk about.
Well, it's been really exciting. It's always exciting to get to be a part of something where we name something that's new to science, get to describe a new species, and in doing so, add to that growing list of fossil species that we know about from Alabama, so that hopefully we can tell the world a little bit more about some of the incredible things that we have here.
Hey, well, keep telling us about it. I'm going to have to get you back on the show soon. We're going to have to talk more fossils and more of the beyond 200 year, beyond the bicentennial history of the state of Alabama.
Looking forward to it.
Drew, thank you so much. This is really fascinating. Put the link up. You can read more about Dr. Drew Gentry from UAB and the fossil find here. 75-million-year-old new species, new genus. Really great read. Check it out. Twitter.com at FM Talk 106.5. And we're coming right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 125 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. By the way, podcast of this show and it's over 40 hours now of live local programming we put out a week from the station, available by going to fmtalk1065.com, clicking the podcast tab. But even more convenient, and not just for a limited time, all the time, subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Spotify. What's the other thing we talked about this morning? Deezer? I'm scared I'm going to say something out. Deezer. Deezer is a podcast. They've got our podcast as well. Check them out and subscribe and get them delivered to your phone, and then you can listen to them at your leisure or share with others, do all those kind of things. All right. Text line here. Yeah, Dan, my man Dan says Bill Finch has been on the Glyptodon Mastodon kick lately. He's been on that kick, Dan, since I've known my buddy Bill Finch. And some of the nerdy conversation that he and I engage in, yes, is about... Can you imagine an 8-foot-long armadillo? I have enough trouble with the damaged armadillos, you know, what they wreak when they're, you know, about a foot long. imagine the holes in your front yard and you get home. My. Also, Eric saying, just like deer and turkey were bigger years ago before the population grew, they adapted to survive, in my opinion. Yeah, I think, Eric, and I don't have it in front of me what the scientific principle is on that, but when there's a scarcity, a lot of that came from the studies on like the Galapagos and all that. You get gigantism, and then you go through, and then you get micro and different versions depending on the resources and over long terms. The change of the armadillo, obviously the progenitor of our armadillo now, was once obviously had more resources, was 8 foot long. My buddy Ben says, probably 15, 20 years ago, I found a shark's tooth in the hills of Wilcox County. You know, I've seen a lot of great shark's teeth from up there. I was up, this was just my last little fossil grab. It was last year, south of Selma, and I was turkey hunting up there, south of Selma, along the Alabama River, and I collected, don't pat me on the back. I didn't do anything amazing. I just came to a chalk bank and started digging through it, and I mean, filled up a vest full. Yeah, it was funny too, where every step I took, it looked like talcum powder shaking out of my vest. But I mean, just big mollusk shells, real intricate ones, what are like periwinkle looking mollusk shells. Just as many as you, I mean, you just dig and there's more and there's more and there's more. Of course, that's the where they were deposited in the old beach back in the day. So it is neat, and once in a while to delve into. I just look at it with us celebrating the bicentennial for the state, and of course Mobile, heck, we're way older, we're well past our tricentennial in Mobile. But then you see a story of a 75 million year old fossil that belonged to a sea turtle, and one that is not directly in line with the ones they've already found. So this is like a new thing, this find for Alabama. It's its own genus and its obviously species, but own genus and then species. It's the only place they found it is here. And to hear Drew talk about our state. I mean, you think about if there's a movie, you know, where they start off with a scene, they're doing archaeology. They're in Mongolia, right? They're in the desert southwest. They're not in Selma, but maybe they should be. All right, coming back. Oh, speaking of mollusk and all those kind of things, when we come back, my buddy Dr. Scott Bannon from Alabama Marine Resources Director is going to join us. We'll talk to him about some really good news. Saw the story this morning. NBC 15 had put this up, and it was good news for Alabama oyster harvest. Now, in the past, we've talked about some of the bad news, right? What makes it tough on oysters around here, and we've had so many years of bad news with oysters. So I'm interested when you see good news, and it's a weird thing. It's kind of good news for us because it's bad news for Louisiana, Mississippi, and their oyster production, which lead the nation, I think. But they are like the big, big McGillas along the Gulf Coast. But all the flooding on the Mississippi River has changed the narrative, and now, at least for this year, Florida has its issues, right? Florida had issues. Now Louisiana, Mississippi has issues, and that puts Alabama in a position with the price up to do some harvesting and maybe get some folks some extra work this year, and that's good news. All right, coming right back, we'll check Dr. Bill's forecast in just a second. We'll come back. Scott Bannon is going to join us. We'll talk some oyster harvest in Alabama right here on Midday Mobile. And the text line is open. Lots of texts coming in. That's cool. I like that. At 343-0106. 343-0106.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Good to have the Director of Alabama Marine Resources, my buddy Scott Bannon, in to talk about. I saw the story this on the, I think, NBC 15, Local 15, Extreme 15 website about oyster and oysters coming back, Alabama being part of producing oysters out there. So thanks for coming back in, and thanks for bringing us news, because usually when you and I have talked, it's been bad news on oyster in here.
Well, and a lot of what we do sometimes is we get bad news, changes in rules and regulations. But in this case, oysters is good news for this time of year. And the last couple of years, the harvest has been terrible. We didn't even have harvest last year at all. We didn't even open a season.
Right.
So for this year to open a season and it has exceeded our expectations is good news. So we're hoping that this is a turning point in the commercial harvest of oysters here in Alabama.
So there's got to be, I want to say two things. There's probably more factors to this, but there's the supply of oysters, whether the season's open, whether the resource can handle it. And then, I mean, let's get down to the economics of it. Is it worth me? I watch those guys tonging. That doesn't look fun. Is it worth me going out? You know, how much money am I going to make to go do this heavy labor?
Well, this year the price was at a historic high for the beginning of the season because
there was a
serious demand in the market because of the freshwater instances that we had in 2019 that destroyed the crops in Louisiana and in Mississippi.
So what happens over there? Because it's a regional market.
It is. It's even a nationwide market. You know, we compete with the East and West Coasts, and
those oysters are bobo.
And you go to different parts of the country, and it's they're a high value product. The Gulf Coast oysters are a high value product, whether it's from our oyster farms or whether it's our wild caught. It's in demand, and so when we had the opportunity this year, our surveys showed that there were some harvestable oysters out there. We developed a harvest plan. And we also anticipated that there would be some good effort, and that the oyster catchers themselves, by the nature of so many boats being out there, would find some areas that we had not surveyed, and that did happen.
Okay.
On the Cedar Point West area, the area near the Cedar Point fishing pier, they found an area we had not surveyed, and that's why we're going to open up again. Right now the waters are closed to
because
the
fresh
high water.
Yeah.
So the Alabama Department of Public Health does that as a preventive measure.
Yeah, and why is that?
It's to ensure that there's no contamination due to runoff. It's not the local local rainfall. It is the North Alabama rainfall. Mm-hmm. So we look at the river stage.
And it's high.
It's high. And it's projected to stay high. Mm-hmm. And then I just looked at the weather again.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be. Yeah.
So we're kind of in a holding pattern right now. But that's a preventive measure because whenever you have these high water events, it could be some sewage overflows mm-hmm. or some other kind of contaminants that could get in the water. So they allow that to pass. And then the Alabama.
So it's not. And it doesn't. It's not. It hadn't killed those oysters. It's just right now not worth. Not safe for harvest.
That's correct, and they could be fine. I mean,
yeah.
they'll go test the waters and get a clean water sample, and we'll open back up. And generally, we do. You know, oysters are filter feeders, and
yes.
So sometimes it takes a little time for them to filter out any contaminants. But if the water doesn't show that they're there, then we're okay. It's a preventive measure.
So it is good news on the survey for the amount of harvestable oysters. And yeah, this story, so the loss for Louisiana and Mississippi, and if people didn't pay attention, Mississippi River, what a flood. I mean, there's a whole other story of the flooding that went along there that I think even people back here just in Alabama weren't aware of, but they had long-term. So we didn't have that. Therefore, we got it's now worth us harvesting these oysters.
Correct. And we did have freshwater impacts and negative impacts.
But not like Mississippi River.
Not nearly like they did. And one of the impacts for us here in Alabama is we're a big processing state. So
yes.
When those states don't provide product, we don't have the ability. There's no product
right.
for us to process.
So yeah, I mentioned that this morning. So, yeah, remind folks, because when we talk about the bayou and stuff, and we think about seafood in the bayou, and sure, there's plenty of shrimp coming in and other things, but it's almost as much about processing that seafood as harvesting it locally.
Absolutely. We are the Gulf Coast largest processor for some products, and so without crabs and oysters, our folks were hurting for jobs. And when we opened up, they used a lot of migrant workers,
right.
legal migrant workers, and so they were going to have to go back. There was no money to support them staying.
Right.
And then so the timing of being able to open for harvest was very helpful to a lot of people, not just the individual catchers, but the stores and the retailers and the restaurants.
Right.
The
they were all ready for the...
Everybody needed some product. Texas opened in November, about 2 weeks before we did, and so they started putting some product in the market, and that was good because our processors could
right.
get some product, but there's still big demand. That is not being met because of the other two states.
Oh, I can tell, because it feels like when I go buy a pint or a quart of oysters, I'm getting punched in the nose for for how much they cost. Do you have the numbers, like when Louisiana and Mississippi, when everything's normal, they account for how much of the harvest? Is it?
I don't know the percentage, but it's the majority. Louisiana.
Okay. They're like the bulk.
Louisiana is the biggest producer. And then Mississippi has some very productive grounds. And they have areas that Alabama... residents go over there and work. They go harvest oysters.
They tong over there?
They generally use dredges.
Dredge,
over there.
Okay.
They do some tonging, and then they dredge over there. And so a lot of Alabama residents go there, and some go to Louisiana. They work on the leases in Louisiana.
Okay.
And some have now gone all the way to Texas to work. So it's a... You know, there was some dire need for people to go to work.
We'll talk oysters and talk about it. We're talking about them here at home. And if you're just joining us, talking to Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon. So your job is what goes on here in Mobile and Baldwin counties. But we talked about west, so let's go east. What's the story with Florida oysters?
It's different over there. They've had
Apalachicola, right? Apalachicola oysters.
And they talk about them being so good, but they had some red tide events and some other events that had negative impacts for them, and they opened up to harvest prior to some of that to allow the product was going to get destroyed. So they allowed some harvest, and so now they're trying to do some rebuilding in that area. So all along the Gulf Coast, we're in kind of a rebuilding phase.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird set of circumstances that we're looking at. What's bad news for Florida, red tide, and Mississippi and Louisiana has been good news for Alabama.
Yes, and so... And freshwater is actually a good thing for us for a certain amount because the predatory snails, the oyster drills, they're the number one enemy of juvenile oysters. And so we had enough freshwater during these freshwater events that it didn't kill our oysters, but it keeps those oyster drills off of them. They do not like freshwater. They like high salinity. So when we had the drought years, the oyster drills, they were feasting on our public oyster reefs, and so now that freshwater kept them pushed back. And
it's interesting the balance out there in
nature.
And
it's a difficult balance. It's very delicate. So right now what we see is a lot of small oysters out there for next year. We see that in our surveys. The harvesters are seeing that on their boats. So we're anticipating a really good year next year. Not the banner years that we used to have,
right?
But it's a step in the right direction, and it looks like it will be a bigger year next year, as long as we don't have any environmental impacts, mm-hmm. such as a drought or a flood or something that would cause some damage.
You know, as we look at this, of course, we're talking about historically a very small amount now compared to what Mobile Bay used to be. And with your department, are y'all looking, I know we've talked about this over the past, restoration efforts, and so are there things being done or things in the pipeline to try to increase the acreage?
Yes.
So we're doing oysterable water.
So we're looking at, you know, why oysters aren't growing where they historically had grown.
Like people will tell the stories that they're dredging out in the middle of the bay.
Absolutely.
In the north end, and there's oyster beds there.
Absolutely. And so there's been changes in the way water flows, and I use the term water quality. That's not necessarily pollution. It's just some things that have changed in the water. And we see low dissolved oxygen on the bottom in some areas, and oysters need that oxygen out of the water. And so we have some programs that we're going to start to elevate some oyster beds to try and see if we can.
Because that's what some of these the oyster farms have done, right? They get them.
Correct. They survive. They're higher in that water column, and they're also in cages, so it keeps the predators off. But if they're on the bottom,
wait, those oyster drills can be kept out with cages?
They can. They will still climb up and
how big is it? So describe to somebody who hadn't, and but we could probably all Google this too.
It's like a hermit crab size, if you think of it like that. But they also, when they're small, they'll climb into those cages and baskets and grow in there if they're given the opportunity.
And they literally drill into the oyster?
They do. They drill a perfect hole in there.
And just suck out the oysters.
Everybody likes oysters, you know, other predatory fish. And it's a numbers game. So you have to have the numbers to overcome the predation.
Right.
And so that's the corner I think we're turning, is that we're seeing that we can overcome that the natural environment is allowing the oysters to grow. And then the oyster catchers turn that bottom and allow the next year's, the spat, to set on that culch material that's out there.
Culch material is just other oyster shells? Or
correct. It could be rocks. We've placed rocks out there, some gravel, and that has worked really well.
They got to have something hard to stick to, right?
Yep.
Which always goes back to the first question, like, you know, you travel back in the time machine. What was the first hard structure that brought the first oyster to the place to make the oyster bed that then made more oysters? Yeah,
the chicken and the egg, right?
It's, I mean, which one was... But when you're talking about these programs and raising up in the water column, you're basically, if we had a magic wand and we could restore water quality to what it was in the long past, those same conditions could be deeper, right?
They could. It's and in different areas, it's different. Water, the way the water flows, and some of the things that cause that low oxygen level is the natural decay of vegetation and things on the bottom.
Right.
You know, there's lots of different reasons why you would have these low dissolved oxygen issues, and so we just have to figure out that we're going to do some shell planting, or we're going to do the things that help impact in a positive way these oyster reefs, but we want to do it in an area we feel very confident they'll survive. And then we're creating an oyster hatchery program. We're going to
How are you hatching oysters, Scott?
I don't know the details.
Been around
of it, but,
chickens before, but that's, yeah, that's I know why you do chickens. But how about oysters?
That's why I hire smart people, and we have a person who's actually started his career in an oyster hatchery, and so he has a lot of experience, and so we're going to do that in our...
Y'all then take the spat and just put them out in the water?
I mean, what we're going to do is, so we'll generate the spat in the larvae stage oyster in our Gulf Shores Claude Petit Mariculture Center, and then we'll bring them over and we'll put them at our Dauphin Island office. We'll have an outside facility that has, cages filled with oyster shell, and we'll dump the larvae in there, and they'll attach to that shell, and we'll let them grow to a certain level, and then we'll then put those live growing oysters out on the reefs to kind of jumpstart the reef system.
Pretty cool. Before we wrap up, you talked about the aquaculture center. Y'all growing a lot of stuff there. You got flounder in there?
We have flounder. We're going to start a spotted sea trout or speckled trout program. We have some pompano. It's a lot of good stuff going on there. We're waiting for the flounder. They are in the stage where hopefully they'll spawn soon, and this will be our first year of a spawn for our flounder.
And you said this is kind of an interesting point. Last time we were talking about this, what we're lacking in our flounder population here are the males, right?
Well, it's a challenge for the males because they don't live long, and they go offshore. And then so when we're trying to do a program, we need males in the system, and they're hard to find. They only grow to just they're under the size limit for Alabama, so you won't even catch males if you're catching legal size flounders.
Those are all females.
Correct.
Where usually that's a weird thing though, because in if I'm thinking about land and mammals, you end up harvesting males because it doesn't affect the population like the females.
That's correct. It is a little bit of a different element, and the females live a lot longer in the flounder world, and so we've gotten some males from Texas, and we've had private anglers that we've issued permits to that have
provided some
fish to us, and it's been a really good citizen science project. So that's how we got our brood stock.
And so those are the ones that are going to provide this next generation
correct.
In the mix. And what do pompano want in a mariculture center? Like, how do you get them to make baby pompano?
They're relatively easy.
Are they?
We leave them in a
put on
in,
some mood in lighting
tanks, and yes, we control the lighting at times because you have to get them into a natural cycle.
Yeah,
and so we've had a very successful program with the pompano. I think we released about 60,000 along the beach last year. So
thank you.
So that's good.
Those of us that like to catch them say thank you.
Absolutely.
All right, just a minute left here before we wrap. Anything people need to know looking forward into the spring? Here
we're working on what will the red snapper season be for this next year, so we're hoping
to make
an announcement probably sometime at the end of February so people can start to make plans. We had a great season this year. It's under full-time state management, so it's we're given the total allowable catch by the federal government, but we manage the season.
Nice work.
Thank you.
As always, I appreciate your time. Thanks for stopping by the show.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Director of Alabama Marine Resources Scott Bannon with us right here on Midday Mobile.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And just stepping off of what my buddy Peter Albrecht just said in headlines there, and what we were talking about in the first hour of Midday Mobile. We talked to Todd Stacey about the opinion coming out from Attorney General Steve Marshall about medical marijuana. We're trying to get him. I'm hoping. So I put out the feelers in contact. In other words, I sent an email and a text to try to get him on the show tomorrow. I hope we can make that happen to get more from him, because I think it is an interesting discussion. Because what if, and back to, this is a song I've been singing for a long time. I said to folks that were legalization advocates for marijuana, I said, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was the best friend y'all had. You just have to look at it, from a little asymmetrical view, because he was doing this crazy thing where he was going to enforce the laws of the land. How about that? And so that would have made it uncomfortable for states that have legalized recreational marijuana or maybe even medical marijuana, but let's stick with recreational. Those people and big weed and all that would have cried to the members of the legislature, and the legislature would have had to make a move. In other words, they would have gone and realized, okay, well, we can't have it. Right now, they have their cake and eat it too, correct? Federal law, it's against the law. But this state over here, they can do their thing. That's it. Can't have it both ways. So I think the discussion would have been forced under Attorney General at that point, Jeff Sessions, but we'll see where that goes. It does bother me. And I am an advocate for medical marijuana. I'm kind of laissez-faire on the rest of it. I don't think it's good for you. If there's a medical condition that's prescribed, but this thing, it fixes everything, whatever. I don't know. We're going to have that proven to me. But at the same time, alcohol is not good for you, okay? And millennials, we found out, are spending $300 a month on it. So you have a situation where these states have chosen to buck federal law, and they're doing it in plain sight, and nothing's happening. So now back here to Alabama. You're the Attorney General of the state of Alabama. He is warning against passing this legislation. Came up last year. And then they tabled it. It did get some traction. It did. They tabled it, and it's going to show up in session this year, which is coming up in like 3 weeks in Montgomery. So the Attorney General warning against it, and he's laying out his reasons, and hopefully we'll have him on the show tomorrow to do it. But I wonder if, this is just the what if, that legislation passes? Okay. And then what would the Attorney General do? Because his job, he's pointing out accurately that it's against federal law, but if you're the Attorney General of the state, who do you defer to? You would defer to state law, wouldn't you? I mean, how many times do we go through this in the state of Alabama? right? I hope I can get him on because it's going to be. I would like to know, what do you do if you're in that position and you're the attorney general and you've given an opinion? Now he's on the record talking about how he thinks it's against law, even medical marijuana. And then all of a sudden the legislature passes it and says, nope, in fact, it's legal in Alabama. And you're the AG, the top of the judicial branch of the state. And you've got, well, I guess Supreme Court is, law enforcement, prosecutorial, judicial branch arm. You're there. And you've got this job of enforcing the laws and abiding by the laws of the state, don't you? I think it's going to be see how that goes, but I think that will be interesting. All right, some people talking about, more people talking about giant armadillos. Hey, by the way, just a side note, I got an email from somebody who said, what books, you know, and I listen, there's probably a whole laundry list of books and that are specific to, you know, fossils in the state of Alabama. The only one here is I was recently, just one on my recent reading list about the Pleistocene, so a lot later. But the fossils, like Dr. Gentry said, you find around here, glyptodons, mastodons, short-faced bears, all that kind of stuff. The Pleistocene, there's a real cool book, a guy, Dan Flores, it's Flores. I'm getting no money off this, not a plug, just something I finished reading. Dan Flores, book called American Serengeti, kind of dives into, it does a couple things. It talks about the Great Plains when you know, we started moving westward across, but it gets into some of the Pleistocene history of the American West, and it's pretty cool. So all right, oh yeah, and thank you, Buck pointed out 300 from our original story, how we started the show off hours ago, that story, millennials spending $300 a month on booze. He did a little equation here. $300 a month would equal 750 natural lights. Thank you. It's good. Good to put a number to it. Paul Feinbaum Show on the way. We'll check back in tomorrow for Mobile Morning starting at 6. Remember, keep up with what's going on through our Facebook page, facebook.com/FMTalk1065, the website, FMTalk1065.com. You can usually rouse me up directly on the Twitter feed at FMTalk1065. Check us out on Instagram and soon to come to, what is it that my kids do? TikTok. As soon as I can figure out what and how to TikTok, then I'll be TikToking. Right now, I'm still ignorant to that. So it is. Paul Feinbaum takes over the reins next. Have a great one.